Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure Podcast. I'm here with Kirk Grace, who's the director of vineyard operations at a very famous winery called Stag's Leap Cellars. You might know it from Judgment of Paris that happened in 1976 and set the world on its head. He's been with Stag's Leap since 2006, I believe.
That's correct.
And so it's quite a tenure, but there's much history to cover prior to that. So I'm very excited to learn more about you.
Okay.
And we'll start with, where were you born? Where did you go to school?
Well, I'm a California native, so I was born in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
Except for a very brief period in Hawaii when my dad was in the Marine Corps,
mm-hmm.
I've spent my entire life in Northern California. I grew up in Orinda, and the family moved here to Santa Elena in 1976.
Momentous.
Yeah, the same year as the tasting. Good point. In fact, you know, the tasting was, it happened the same summer that we moved here.
How about that?
And it was a moment that got a brief amount of attention locally and then kind of went quiet for a little while until people realized what the actual impact of that tasting was. And then obviously quite a big period of pride and celebration regarding that tasting.
Yeah, it's historic in so many regards, and to this day remains something that I feel quite reverent.
It brought not just Napa Valley and not just California, but the fact that great wine did not have to exclusively originate from France.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of opened up the world's attention to the fact that great wine could be made in other places as well.
Absolutely. It still stirs up a lot of emotions, as I've learned myself relatively recently. I went to a writer's conference a couple of years ago, and Steven Spurrier was a keynote speaker. And there was a French journalist that challenged him about the wine choices. She actually said that in her mind, he chose not the top French producers, but top California producers. So the implication was that somehow he had a bias towards California. He disabused her from that in very, very strong terms. So it was interesting to hear that, though, because clearly it's indicative of how dramatic that was.
Sure.
And how much, you know, yeah, it's still a sore spot. I believe that.
Right. Well, and there was not much of a network for that kind of wine knowledge at that time,
mm-hmm.
here in California anyway. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you could necessarily say cherry picked,
because
there was the fact that there was, you know, a pretty limited number of wineries and didn't have a lot to choose from.
Absolutely. And he had a wine shop in Paris, and he chose, according to him, the best wines he had that he loved to drink. So his intention was basically to educate people. It was never to put California on the map.
Right.
That was a byproduct.
Yeah.
So back to California.
Right, right.
So you grew up in the East Bay and then subsequently in Napa Valley, which at the time seemed to look very different, I bet, than it does today.
It was a quiet little town. It was easy to stop on Main Street and talk to somebody on the sidewalk. And obviously, it has grown exponentially from a traffic standpoint there. And if you were to do that now, you'd get a lot of people honking their horns at you.
I could just picture that. I've been coming to Napa Valley for quite some time, and it's changed right before my eyes. But for you, it must have been even more dramatic.
One of the great things about Santa Elena that I still remember was when we moved there, if you were making a local phone call, you only had to dial four numbers.
That's great. So what was it like growing up? I mean, obviously very communal. It's a beautiful spot, but far less developed. And
It was a lot of small agriculture.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, wine grapes were a very big part of it, but cattle actually was an even bigger industry at that time. 76 was the last year where, if you look at the county agricultural reports, where livestock proceeds were greater than fruit proceeds. $15 million in livestock and $13 million in fruit. And
incredible.
Last year was about $4.5 million in livestock and several hundred million dollars in fruit sales.
Wow. So your dad, your mom and dad, at that point, what were they up to?
Well, my dad was a business stockbroker investor in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Would wake up very early in the morning and be down to San Francisco within an hour and a quarter for the opening bell, and then would leave the Bay Area, I don't know, say 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and be home pretty easily before 5 o'clock. As a hobby, planted a small vineyard on our property, and found Camus Vineyards, who were originally interested in that fruit, and Charles Wagner,
yeah.
Senior,
yeah.
Liked the fruit and offered to keep it separate and make a vineyard designate out of that wine, and began the story of Grace Family Vineyards. You know, originally it was a hobby, and through the Camus adventure and then subsequently our own small winery, gained international fame as a premium small producer of Cabernet here in the Napa Valley.
Just amazing to me. Why weren't you guys living in San Francisco closer to his work? I mean, why did he choose St. Helena?
I think he wanted to remove himself from kind of a trend that he saw happening in the Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
And the family. It was a wonderfully innocent and simple time. People ask me what it was like to grow up here at that time, and I compare it to what I think Huckleberry Finn experienced.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah. You know, there was a lot of wide open spaces, and it was easy to ride horses throughout the valley without any interruption, and just a really special place, and mm-hmm. lots of pasture and lots of, you know, it was always in private hands, just as it is now, but borders were very blurred, and it was easy to move around in the valley without having to feel that you were trespassing into other people's privacy.
It's difficult to picture it this way, but it sounds remarkable to have
this
fun. Kind of freedom
and the skill set of the people that were, mm. you know, had really carved out their livings here. Everybody knew how to farm their own properties, and mm-hmm. I was always impressed and jealous of my classmates who were able to drive tractors and buck hay and do the, you know, a hard day's work and then play really hard also.
Wow. So I actually saw your dad zipping his Topolino on 29 a few times. He was a great sight.
Yeah.
He's, you know, I met him a few times. He was such a generous person, and everyone in the community just adores, you know, so much positive. Before I even ever knew that you had a wine brand, I knew that there's the Grace that everybody loved.
Yeah. Well, he's a larger than life in many respects.
Yes.
And still very dedicated to people in need, especially children with medical and educational needs, and enthusiastically supports them and promotes those causes for people that are less fortunate than we are.
You know, a lot of people think that Scream Eagle is the first California cult wine, but it's quite incorrect. It happens to be Grace Family. Talk about the history.
Yeah, you know, it was funny. Growing up in it, I can't say that I was all that aware of it.
Yeah.
I loved agriculture, and I knew I was always going to work in agriculture, but it was so much a part of our lives that we didn't really see it as out of the ordinary, especially since so many other people were coming to prominence at the same time. I mean, mm-hmm. maybe on different scales, but nonetheless achieving quite a bit of recognition, you know, Schramsberg and mm-hmm. Duckhorn and mm-hmm. any number of other labels that were coming to prominence at that time.
I remember seeing the bottle for the first time. I think it might have been in the wine shop, and I just was mesmerized. It was this etched bottle in a wood box. You know, this days it's not as uncommon, but then it was pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was told a story that there's this wine that's made in minuscule quantities and such like that. Later found out that there's a charitable element that mm-hmm. you just touched upon that was really important to your dad. So tell me more about this. How did the concept started? And
I don't know. He's always been a big proponent of the arts. Mm-hmm. And I think really the first foray into those specialized bottles was for the early years in the wine auction. Mm-hmm. And trying to offer something that was unique and still very wine focused mm-hmm. and maybe less experientially focused like many of the offerings are right now. And the way of doing that was to use special packaging, you know, a bottle that was artistically unique and offered in a wooden case, you know, very simple, but at the same time, very personal and unique, especially mm-hmm. at that time.
Yeah, you're referencing, of course, Auction Napa Valley, a very famous auction that raises money for charities. And mm-hmm. your dad was such a prominent donor. You know, people chased the wines, and that's where they could get it. And
exactly.
I think your first vintage must have been, what, 100 cases or less?
Gosh, I don't know. It was. I know the first vintage was 78.
78.
Well, as a vineyard designate from Camus.
Okay, 78.
The first Grace Family Vineyard offering, I think, was 82 or 83, but I'm not confident on that.
That's amazing. And how long did that brand?
Oh, it's still in existence.
It's still in existence.
Yeah, we did just you know, it became a family decision that it's too small to really be able to pass down mm-hmm. and create or continue the label as my dad had envisioned it, mm-hmm. or my mom and dad, I should say. I got to mm-hmm. give my mom credit for that as well. And then, just to be fair to the siblings, they decided that the best course of action was to sell it. So it was sold, gosh, only about 4 or 5 months ago.
Oh my goodness. May I ask to whom?
Jeremy and Catherine Green.
Okay.
It was very important to us to be able to sell to a family and okay. not to larger investors. Mm-hmm. And so there was a good deal of thought and consideration put into finding the proper person to pass it on to. And they are very generous in their own right and enthusiastic. And I think we'll do a great job. And one of the really neat things about it is that they allowed my parents to stay on the property, which was a huge huge importance to mm-hmm. both my mom and dad, and mm-hmm. I think they're very grateful for that opportunity.
Wonderful. Yeah, I haven't seen your wine in a while, but it's direct to consumer, so I wouldn't necessarily spot it.
Yeah,
the important bottle shops. So.
There's a few shops that might carry it. They participate in the same subscription letter that any other customer does.
You don't sell any wholesale ever.
No.
Wow.
No.
That's think about that alone.
Yeah.
That's kind of a unicorn these days.
Yeah, it's hard to pull off nowadays.
Yeah. And what's the case production? Just out of curiosity, it's still pretty small.
I'm guessing about 800. Well. Off of just the Grace Family Vineyard, 200 to 300 cases.
That's nothing.
Yeah, very small.
Who's the winemaker?
Helen Keplinger.
Very good.
Yeah, she came on board, I think 2014 was her first vintage.
Okay. Before that, it was, I know Heidi Barrett at some point.
And then Gary Brookman.
And then Gary Brookman.
Yeah.
Okay, so amazing people, you know, this is a stellar winemaker.
A lot of talent.
Obviously.
A lot of talent.
Tons of talent, but again, succession, only 3 winemakers, right?
There had been Gary Galleron prior to Heidi Barrett, but, you know, all of them had a fair amount of tenure. It's not like we rotated through winemakers fast clip.
A lot of times, famous brands seem to go through winemakers pretty quickly, but you guys held on to
these
remarkable people. So
yeah,
wow, what a legacy to be a part of.
It was, you know, it's been it's been a special journey, and it's opened a lot of doors for me as well. I think certainly working here at Stag's Leap has part of that was that part of my original ability to work here was that they appreciated what we'd accomplished at Grace as well.
Oh, interesting. So you were surrounded, you were in the middle of, you know, viticulture, even though it wasn't as robust at the time as we talked about as other agricultural products. At what point do you realize that this really is the love of your life?
I knew even as a young kid that I was going to work in agriculture. I love the environment, and I think that agriculture, the intersection of agriculture and the environment is a very special place, and done right, it is additive and enhances the environment, and obviously done wrong can be very detrimental to the environment. And I take a lot of pride in trying to do it in a way that works with the environment, not against it.
And it was initially observational. You didn't have any formal education. When you were a kid, a teenager, you were just so in tune with that it was something that...
I knew right away, yeah. Okay. And I always have had a talent of being able to walk onto a property and recognize whether it was healthy or not, or if certain types of work had to be done. And so, you know,
even as a teenager, you were able to do that?
Yeah.
Okay, I have to
ask. I mean, we started doing deficit irrigation and canopy control back in the early 80s when people didn't even know what that was.
No, people were farming for yields then.
Well, they were farming for yields, or they were just letting, you know, California sprawl, which is, you know, a very nice and beautiful way to farm, but there's ways of even enhancing that through fruit exposure and fruit arrangement that we were using from the get-go.
That is pretty remarkable that you knew back then deficit irrigation. Yeah. I mean, how did you even come up with that? Was it studying the vine or...
You know, that's interesting. I think so much knowledge is passed on. We share knowledge so freely here in the Napa Valley that I can't say it's originally my thoughts or my knowledge, but it's more building on the networks of what other people have done already. Wow. And then incorporating it into your own system. I always joke that you can ask four vineyard managers their opinion about something and you'll get six answers.
I'm sure that's true. I'm just fascinated because at the time, I don't know if there were practices, you know, digging up soil pits and looking at the root architecture, anything like that. I'm guessing not.
No, I didn't. So I worked at Sterling for a brief period, and that was the first time I'd ever dug a soil pit. And that was back in the later 80s, where the idea of looking at what was beneath the surface became really important in deciding how to develop a vineyard.
Wow, so you worked on property obviously from an early age, and then decided to go to school for viticulture, so?
A long, colorful college career that I completed finally at Cal Poly down in San Luis Obispo. Okay. I would go to school for 6 months, and then I would work for 6 months. I was here in the Napa Valley and had my own little tractor and a small truck, and would work for that period of time and save up as much money as I could and then go back to school again.
So you paid for your own school?
Oh, I had help.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
But at the same time, I was expected to contribute to that education.
Obviously, your dad had very strong values.
Yeah. He's a strong personality.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to make things too easy for anybody. And so he put that same responsibility onto us kids as well. And he didn't want to give us any more of a free ride than anybody else.
God, I wish there was more of that. Do we consider him a mentor?
Yeah, he was a visionary, is a visionary, and certainly one of my first teachers. You know, he's ex-Marine Corps, and we spent many hours out in the vineyard straightening out vineyard stakes so that they were standing up straight, not only down the line, but across the line.
I love that. How many brothers and sisters do you have?
One brother and one
just
sister.
One brother and one sister. Yeah. Okay. And they're not involved in
the decision? No, they both anyway. Live down in the Sausalito County, or Marin County, excuse
yeah.
me.
Yeah. So you're the only one that took yeah, to it.
That's right.
Wow. So you finished Cal Poly, and you wanted to come back to Napa Valley at that point.
Right.
Is that right?
My wife and I, my wife grew up in the Napa Valley. She's a Lincoln. They first came to the Napa Valley in the 1850s.
Oh, my goodness.
And lived continuously on the same property from the mid-1890s until they sold it, I think, in 2013. And again, her parents were given a lifetime estate with a certain parameters, and so it was sad for the family to see that property sell as well, but at the same time it afforded her parents a wonderful old age.
Golden years,
exactly. So we moved back here right after school. We were married in 84 and moved back here right after school in 86.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been working in vineyards ever since.
That's amazing continuity and consistency.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
So what was your first job when you moved back to the Valley?
I've been working for the S's. First job was Sterling. And then I went to Saint-Supery. Briefly worked with a vineyard manager by the name of Larry Bettinelli. And actually learned quite a bit from him as far as managing larger properties.
Mm-hmm.
And then went to Sinsky Vineyards, mm-hmm. and I worked there for 10 years. And then in 2006, was approached by Stag's Leap Wine Cellars.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate at Sinsky's. They had a true dedication to organics and biodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt that the best way to accomplish their goals was to bring that farming in-house. And so they started a vineyard management company, not vineyard management, in-house management
yes,
company
yeah.
From scratch. And they asked me to put that together. So I from building an office inside of a barn to purchasing equipment and putting together the first labor crew, built a company for them that... ultimately certified all of their properties organic and biodynamic.
That's fantastic. At the time, obviously, it wasn't something that is a hot topic of conversation like it is
no.
today.
In fact, so, we would have piles of compost piled up out in front of the vineyards that we were spreading out post-harvest, which is the most common time to put it out. And we would have people stop on the side of the road and look at these compost piles and ask us what they were. And they were pioneers in cover cropping
yeah.
long before it was required as part of an erosion control method. And so it was a wonderful place to experiment and learn and hopefully contribute to their cause as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just became a foundation and a springboard that ultimately brought me here to Stag's Leap.
So Robert Sinsky, in essence, had discovered somewhere along the line in his own history that this is an important value he holds. And he
right, and the winemaker, Jeff Vernig.
Okay.
I think both of them became first enamored and attracted to organic agriculture, mm-hmm. and then it became a deep personal value for both of them.
Very interesting. And you obviously were engaged in it in terms of he wanted to implement it, so
mm-hmm.
did you have to learn everything from scratch? How did you even...
Well, I already had I've always been a gardener, and I had always been attracted to organic agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Had several heated conversations with my Cal Poly professors is I was told that it was impossible to farm grapes organically. You know, we learned very quickly that it's actually fairly easy to do. There's great materials out there that we can use. And it really comes down to being attentive and using good soil management practices and using the tools that have been around for since ancient times as far mm-hmm. as how to grow vines and develop canopies in such a way that are healthy and don't need a significant amount of chemical inputs.
So an average consumer probably doesn't understand what organics is. There's a lot of misinformation I mm-hmm. find, and it became a marketing term. So
right.
I want them to hear from you. What does it mean?
Well, one of the biggest misnomers is you'll often hear people say that they're practicing organics and they don't use pesticides. Mm-hmm. And that's not true. They do use pesticides. They just are derived in a way that is less synthetic, less damaging than more natural materials, mineral oils. We use sulfur a lot in organics. So really what organics is taking the synthetic materials out of the equation as you're doing your farming, whether it's fertilizers, you know, we use natural fertilizers, composts, rock minerals principally. We don't use salt chemistries, mm-hmm. Salt fertilizers, and of course we don't use synthetic mm-hmm. Fungicides and insecticides. Again, they're naturally derived.
So this is the most important, like, fundamentals of organics. Is there anything else that people should know when they're looking for at product on the label and see organic?
Well, you know, I think there's also one of the things we need to caution ourselves about is that there's very good conventional farmers, mm-hmm. and there's also very bad organic farmers. And
well put.
So you know, how someone still treats the land is what I ultimately use as my measurement. And I should qualify that we don't use exclusively organic principles here at Stag's Leap. We do practice sustainable agriculture, which I know can be easily maligned because the idea of sustainable can be corrupted. Mm-hmm. People can say they go out and count bugs and then they spray and they call that sustainable agriculture. And that might be one step up the sustainable ladder, but sustainability also really is looking out after the environmental health of the property, the physical health of the workers, and the conduct that we use as we function in the community as well.
Wow, so it's a far more holistic approach than people realize.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we don't farm just the vineyard. We are responsible for the outlying areas beyond the vineyard as well. And we have to treat that in such a way that maintains its health. It makes the vineyard healthier, and it keeps the environment healthy outside of that vineyard environment as well.
And it's not always a fit to farm a vineyard organically, just as a general rule, right?
Well, I think a great example would be some of the controversies about certain materials that are used, and you know, I hate to bring up the Roundup word, but mm-hmm. it is one of the tools. I think it's been abused, but the alternative to Roundup in organic agriculture might greatly increase your carbon footprint. And so we have to ask ourselves which is the greater evil, or which is the least harmful, not just to the property, but to the greater environment and community.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.